If you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life.
Welcome to Back in America, the podcast.
I am Stan Berthelot, and this is Back in America, a podcast exploring America's culture, values, and identity. This conversation was recorded live and broadcasted to YouTube, Facebook, and LinkedIn. You can watch the full unedited version on our social media profiles. As always, if you like this episode, share it with your friends. I'm super grateful for your listening to my podcast, and I am always looking for ways to give back to you, my friend. So, I would like to invite you to record your own introduction to Back in America. Take your voice recorder on your phone and just say, "Hi, I am," your name, and "This is Back in America." And just send it to stan@backinamericathepodcast.com. I look forward to your contribution. And now, the episode. So after doing a series of interviews about the collapse of our civilization, I really wanted to speak with someone to give us hope, someone realistic enough to see the current planetary crisis, but someone who can direct us toward making positive changes to ensure a better tomorrow. My guest, Navy Raju, will join us in just a minute. He is an internationally renowned French, Indian, and American scholar, an innovation and leadership advisor, and a best-selling author based in New York. Navy's most recent book, Frugal Innovation, How to Do More with Less, was published in 2015 by The Economist, and it shows how companies can innovate faster, better, and in a sustainable manner. Welcome to Back in America, Navy.
Thanks for having me, Stan.
How are you today?
Good, I'm great. Thank you.
And you are in New York, right?
In Manhattan, yes, Upper West.
In Manhattan. Okay, excellent. So we've got several things in common, I think. One of it is we are both French. I'm French and I live in the States, in Princeton. And you are also French and you live in New York. But tell me, you've got three passports. Tell me more about your origin and where you grew up.
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in Pondicherry, which is a former French colony in southern India. And the city was made famous by the book as well as the movie Life of Pi, for those of you who watched it. Mm-hmm. So I went to French high school there, which is the second, I believe, oldest French high school outside France, I believe, or at least in Asia. And then I came to Paris to do my higher education. And then in 1998, I came to the US to first study. And then I ended up working here. So I've been here for 20 years. So yes, so I hold a French passport. I also have a kind of Indian passport that allows me to go to India anytime. And then in 2016, I got my US citizenship as well.
So you are pretty multicultural. And as such, I think you understand the importance of culture, values, and identity, which is what we explore in this podcast, right?
Yes, absolutely. So, yes.
And this is fascinating because we are going to talk about the Great Reset, as the World Economic Forum calls it. And the Great Reset is really something that, according to them, will help our civilization transition towards sustainability. And your research in India and in Europe led you to recommend frugal economy and B2B sharing. This is amazing, and I want to learn more about what it is in just a few words, if you can.
Everybody's criticizing capitalism, but nobody's offering an alternative, right? So, and the brain, you know, according to neuroscience, tends to cling to what is familiar until, you know, we see something new. So my job is to introduce Americans to new ways of doing business, new ways of creating economic and social value in a sustainable way. So the frugal economy essentially is a new economy that is built on three pillars. The first one is business-to-business sharing. The same way that the last Great Recession, we saw the rise of Airbnb and Uber, right? The sharing economy among consumers like us. Now we are seeing businesses sharing their resources to each other. That's very exciting. And then the second pillar is this notion that if you think about from the Industrial Revolution, right? And until recently, we had mass production essentially done in China. And then actually it's happening right now, right? In current affairs, right? Because, you know, China with COVID, we saw what happened, right? The whole global supply chains get crippled, right? And so suddenly we cannot even get basic items in this country because they're all made in China. And then we saw what happened in the Suez Canal because not only they are mass produced, but they are mass shipped, right? In big containers. So the new model is thanks to technologies like 3D printing, as well as micro factories, smaller factories that are no bigger than a container. It's becoming possible now to make products as close as, you know, to the customers as possible. So we are going to see actually a revival of US manufacturing thanks to this trend. And then the third pillar is this notion of regeneration. It's actually the whole notion, the whole idea of going beyond sustainability. If you think about sustainability, it's essentially about saying, oh, we need to do less harm to the planet by reducing our carbon emissions. But regeneration goes one step further and says, how can we as companies consciously have a positive impact on society and the planet?
If I hear you well, this new model is a way to continue operating as we do today, continuing on the same idea of consumption, production, while having a better impact socially and on the environment.
To some extent, yes, except that, as you can see, right, the notion of consumption itself changes as well as production. So because the if you think about consumption, production, or supply or demand, right, these are the two aspects of market economy. Essentially, it was people consuming individually. That's why in America, not only we call consumerism, but we also talk about individualism, right? So everybody is consuming separately. So the first step is to say, hey, why do we do this in an independent way, right? How do we begin to do this together? So this is called collaborative consumption, which has become, you know, the sharing economy. And now we are seeing the same thing happening in the production side as well. And then, yes, we will, you know, we still have to produce things, right? I mean, it's not like we are going to go back to the becoming like a caveman, right, in the old times. So we still have to produce goods and services. The question is like, you know, can we produce them in a way that doesn't, you know, create what we call negative externalities, that is basically doing harm, you know, to society by creating inequality and do harm to the planet, right? And by creating more, you know, pollutions as well as consuming a lot of natural resources. So I would say that it's more moving to a virtuous way of consuming and producing. And then if you keep pushing it further, we are going to go essentially to, and it's happening in Nordic region and to some extent in France as well. And it's also what was happening when I was growing up as a kid in India, is the whole idea that the line between producer and consumer will blur. So essentially I can start producing my own goods, right? Mm. And we're already seeing that, right? People like, you know, making their own products, you know, with 3D printers. People, you know, of course, they've been, you know, growing food in their own garden, right? It's the first step. So I think it's going to start that way, right? This idea of, you know, the old model is like, you know, a few people controlling the tools of production and everybody consuming separately, to a model where we start sharing our production tools and assets, resources in a collaborative way, and people also starting to consume more local, more frugal way. And then potentially we might go to a different model altogether where we say, why do I have to buy something, you know?
And that is something that you mentioned in an article that you published on Wednesday on the magazine Fast Company, right? Where you talk about business to business and the sharing economy again. Can you give us some examples that you've seen from your eyes of companies that are actually doing that, you know, sharing their resources, their warehouses, maybe their means of production, as well as their intellectual property?
We think everything is going badly in America, but actually there are many new startups emerging, which is very exciting. And they are essentially the Ubers of a different kind of transaction, right? Which excites me because, you know, Uber is great, you know, Airbnb is nice. These guys, these new platforms are emerging, right? By startups in, not only in Silicon Valley, actually they're based in New York, in Chicago, et cetera. They're helping companies, as you rightly said, to share different things. So I'm going to give some examples in a minute, but as you rightly pointed out, they help them share, you know, everything from free warehouse capacity to idle factory capacity, employees, and all the way to intellectual property. So, for example, there is a platform called Zoometry. It's a U.S. Startup. And what they do is they connect big industrial firms like GE and or Dell with small, mid-sized manufacturers. As you know, the mid-sized companies in America suffered the most from COVID. And what happens is that, you know, if you're a large company and you're trying to make a new product, instead of building your own factory, right, you can actually look into this platform and see which mid-sized company in Ohio or in Pennsylvania may have these highly specialized, right? These are not commodity stuff that, you know, you get from China, right? These are highly specialized, high value adding mid-sized manufacturers located, you know, in Ohio and other industrial states. And then it allows this platform to electronically share resources. So essentially, I design a product and then I can send the drawing to this platform and it will optimize the design and then send it to the, you know, the mid-sized company in Ohio, and it can track exactly where it is. And if there is a problem, it can warn both parties and improve that, et cetera, et cetera. I think it kind of levels the playing field. It allows basically even the small, mid-sized, you know, family-owned manufacturing companies to be plugged, right, into the internet and offer their industrial services to other, you know, Fortune 500 companies. So that's one example I particularly like, because I don't want to get in politics, but if you see what happened in the recent 4 or 5 years, right, is we saw the industrial belt, you know, being decimated because of outsourcing in America. So this is a way of bringing back manufacturing, right, to America. But we shouldn't bring back manufacturing and make big factories. That's what I'm saying, right? We need to use these platforms to distribute, you know, the supply capabilities across a network of small manufacturers across America so they can also benefit. And the local communities, right, can thrive as well. Since we are in the B2B sharing, during COVID, the IT service company Accenture teamed up with Verizon and other companies to set up a platform called the People and Work Connect. It's an employer-to-employer platform that enables employees that got laid off in one company to quickly find a job in another company. So in the process, it reduces the long wait period for these people who have been laid off, which is quite dramatic. So that's about sharing employees, right? That's one way to think about it. And then the intellectual property, Unilever, which is a big consumer good company, that did something amazing is they developed this proprietary technology to reduce the amount of aluminium used to make the aerosol, you know, the deodorant cans. That reduces the emissions. It's good for the planet without reducing the performance. And once they develop the technology, they share this IP, intellectual property, with even rivals, because they say, look, the whole industry has to increase, you know, its environmental standards. So we have no problem, you know, sharing our intellectual property with other companies. So these are some examples of companies who are beginning to share everything from factory capacity, warehouse capacity, truck. 30% of the trucks running on highways in America are running empty, right? So there's a platform called Convoy that actually combines multiple truckload shipments into a single job for drivers. So that reduces emissions by 45%. So that's good for the driver, It's good for the economy and it's good for the planet.
If I play devil's advocate, don't we run into the risk of seeing the Uberization of businesses, just like we saw with Uber, that provide great jobs? I don't know if it's great, but jobs for people who need jobs. But then who, a few months down the road, will start to wonder, where is my healthcare? They are treating me like an employee without any benefits of being an employee. So that's question number one. And question number two is, again, just like we saw with the internet, with startups, with every new thing, where we start by going, wow, this is fantastic, and everybody is on the same playing field, to, well, in the end, the bigger you are, the more successful you will be. So again, in this new model, don't we run having the risk of seeing, you know, large corporation just engaging actively into this model of sharing and frugal economy to make the most of it?
No, it's definitely, you make a good point. As a matter of fact, a couple of ideas here. So the article I published in Fast Company is the first article in a series. And the third article I'm going to publish is showing the difference between what I call smart sharing and wise sharing. So what I'm saying is that you're right. Smart sharing is essentially saying we are going to share things only to increase the performance, right, of the economy, or as you said, to make more profit for a few companies. The wise sharing says, no, we are going to share resources, but for a noble cause, right? Noble cause could be creating opportunities, right, in local communities, right, in the land of America. It could be, and I'll give you an example in a minute, a great example, by the way, it's about improving healthcare, you know, so that Americans are healthier. It could be reducing damage to the planet. That is wise sharing, right? So yes, so that's why I see. So the problem is, you know, if you only focus on, we say this is the best sharing, right? What about the other people who say, look, you know, I'm more interested in economic performance first, right? Then I'm going to think about the planet. So that's why when I write articles, I don't try to pick a side. I say, look, here is a new approach, right? Then, of course, what matters is your motivation, right? What is the Buddha famously said, a knife in the hand of a thief is life-threatening, but the same knife in the hand of a surgeon is life-giving. It's just a tool, right? Everything we discussed so far are just tools. What matters is the intention of the person using the tool. One example I can give you of wise sharing, and this is my favorite one because I hate the fact that we live in this richest country of the world called America, and where 22% of Americans can't afford still, right, to go see a doctor because it's expensive. So healthcare is a big problem. We know that. And one of the problems is because the cost of drugs is so high, right? Many people can afford to buy drugs. So 1,400 hospitals in America who represent about 30% of beds capacity in America. That's quite important, right? They gang together to create a nonprofit called Civica RX. Again, right, these are not big hospital chains. They are, you know, mid-size, you know, kind of, but they come together, right? So they pool their purchasing power to buy generic drugs that are all made in America. Because you know that in COVID, we found out that actually, like, you know, 50% of the active ingredients used in drugs sold in America are all imported, right? That's crazy. So these guys saying, no, we are going to make drugs 100% in America. And of course, the reason it wasn't made before is because if you are a contract manufacturing company, right, making these kind of drugs in America, you don't have enough demand. The big pharma companies, right, they all outsource manufacturing. And so hospitals had no choice than to go to the big pharma companies and say, please give us the drugs. So what ended up happening is that drug prices went up, right, sometime, right? There's a spike, huge spike, which is not good for hospitals. They have to pay a lot more money to get drugs. And as well as the supply was unpredictable, right? If there's like a crisis like COVID, global supply chains are crippled, that's it. You have a short bottleneck and you have a shortage of drugs. So this nonprofit, it's called Civica RX, C-I-V-I-C-A RX. So that's an example of hospitals sharing, not to make more money necessarily, but maybe to save a bit of money, surely. But more importantly, what they're doing is they're taking these off-patent drugs that are critical for patients suffering from, you know, cancer, chronic diseases, debilitating ailments, and then they can make them in large quantity and share them across the members in this network. So you're going to see, yes, you're going to see the kind of the bad applications of B2B sharing, like Uber. We cannot stop that. But what makes me optimistic is that we're going to also see very inspiring examples of B2B sharing, like the Civica RX that I talked about.
I want to sort of come back to the idea of culture and values in this country in particular. And I'm going to refer back to an article you published in 2018, where you wrote that if we want to survive and thrive, we need a radical shift in consciousness. We must learn to value the quality of life over the quantity in life. Tell us what you meant at the time, and tell us whether in the last 3 years your view have changed.
Right. I think COVID, we talk about, it's called back in America, right? And now we are talking about back to normal. There is no back to normal, first of all, right? We know that. We have to accept the fact. Instead, I think we need to go back to basics, reevaluate our lives and say, will having an extra car or, you know, a bigger house will make me happier? Or is it spending more time with my family? And I think COVID gave a resounding answer to that question.
Yeah, well, and I want to take you on that. I mean, you said there is no coming back to what it was before. I've been really challenged with that. And yet we all know, and in fact, we know it's already starting, people are just dying to get back into an airplane and to start to travel. Yes, maybe people will remote work more than they did before. Are they really going to change the way they live, the people? Or are we just all dying to go back to what it was before? I'm not sure about that.
Well, I have an answer to that. I mean, let me start with some statistics. So if you look at the Generation Z, our generation, of course, you and I, you know, I think we are financially a bit better off. Let's be candid, right? But if you look at the Gen Z, right, all the research shows that they are going to be the first generation which is going to be financially in really bad shape. As a matter of fact, they have almost no savings. They're already loaded with debt, right? So this generation is going to be very frugal. As a matter of fact, that's why the millennials, the previous generation, were the biggest customers of the previous sharing economy, like Uber, Airbnb, right? Because they couldn't afford to, or didn't want to actually, right, own stuff. They preferred to share them as a service. So I think you're going to see, essentially what I'm getting at is that there is a socio-demographic shift happening that is going to anyway reinforce these things we are talking about today, right? So because we have the young generation, which is more socially conscious, more ecologically conscious, but also has less money. So we are seeing the young people saving more, right? This is something we've never seen before in America. So I think your question is like, you know, what is the new? I think the new may not be 100% different because the pendulum never swings like this, right? From one extreme to another. So we are going to find a middle ground where you might see people. I also died to get on a plane, but I must confess that, you know, I might be flying less because I realize that I can accomplish so much more, you know, by video mm-hmm. now. So yes, we'll go back to some of the older ways of doing things, but there are certain areas where I think things will radically change, like the commitment to Black Lives Matter, inequality, you know, women inclusion and women empowerment. These are things that I think last year, right, became something we can't, like, you know, hide anymore, right? These are issues that are, you know, really afflicting American society. So I think you're going to see the social engagement, environmental engagement among companies go up. But if you're asking me, you know, and I'm also sometimes cynical, are they going to, like, stop selling stuff? I live in Manhattan, right? See, the changes may not be visible, right? It's not the thing you're going to see in the street. I think what I'm interested, and that's why your program, right, is on values, identity. These are things that are more invisible, mm-hmm. right?
People will be looking for a sense in what they do.
That's exactly
maybe
right.
Maybe more, yeah.
Right. So the changes are going to be within what happened, the psyche of people, right, in the perspective. more than in the behavior.
Keeping this conversation on culture of value, I want to do two things. Pretty soon, I will share with you an audio clip from my interview with John Michael Greer, who, as you know, is a thinker, a philosopher, someone who has written a lot about the Great Descent, which is sort of the end of our civilization. He wrote that it's going to take a long time, the long descent. It's going to take a long time, but he sees it happening already, and he believes that our civilization is drawing to an end. The clip I'm going to play is more about what's so particular about the American culture. As you listen to that, I would like you to tell me if we trust what he says, if we agree with what he says, how do you see this culture, America, embracing the change that you're recommending?
Europe is not North America. This is one of the things that both Europeans and North Americans sometimes forget. In the United States, we're going to be dealing with independence and with that sort of independent-minded thing because that's hardwired into our culture. Basically everybody clings to that. And trying to convince people to give it up is not going to get anywhere. So if that's, that's what we have to work with. Obviously, in many European countries, you have a more communal attitude. You have a more locally based, neighborhood based kind of approach to society. There are those connections that are much more closer. There are more bonds between people in specific areas and so on. And so you've got that to work with, and that's what you should be working with. You work with what you have. Go out west and it's every man for himself. And so here again, one of the basic principles here is that there is no one solution. There is no one way.
It's a very interesting point that John Greer is bringing up, right? Is the contrast between the U.S., which is more geared towards individual freedom, and Europe, and I would even say Asia, right, which is more oriented towards social values and community, etc. What if I tell you something, because that's exactly going to be the focus of my next book called Conscious Society. And the book actually says, why do we have to choose? Why can't we have both? Why can't we go into a kind of a third dimension, so to speak, where we try to integrate the goodness of America and the goodness of Europe? And both of us, we are French and American, and I'm Indian too. So within myself, I'm trying to do integration. So let me make it more practical. Well, it means that essentially, sure, many people have studied Scandinavia, right? Held as a role model for community values and communitarian kind of values, which I admire too. But what has also been studied is how that stifles innovation, because it's not a society that allows too much individual expression. And this is why I really recommend you to read an excellent book called The Evolving Self by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. He's famous for writing another book which introduced the famous concept of flow, the notion of flow. So this comes from this author, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. But his other book is one of the fathers of positive psychology. So, his book is called Evolving Self. And I'm actually using that framework that says that an ideal society is the one that tried to find the sweet spot between maximizing individual expression. So that's one axis. And the other axis, while contributing to social integration. Because if you go too much social integration, it ends up being communism. If you go too much into individual expression, well, it's like cancer. Cancer is what? Is a bunch of cells going rogue and trying to optimize their individual expression. That's a cancerous body. And so what you need is actually look at the human body, right? Is we have highly specialized cells that excel in differentiation. That's a technical term. It comes from evolutionary biology, right? From nature, where everything is different. There's a lot of diversity. But there is harmony as well, because they work together. The same is happening, in a human body as well. If you want to look at a new societal model, we should look at nature as well as within our own human body. And I think so that's what, this book I'm writing about is all about.
This is very interesting. I hear you say that several things, actually, that maybe this pandemic made us understand, you know, the importance of value, the importance of going back to a more communal approach, the sharing economy brought to a larger model, to how you can apply that to enterprise and all that. So people will be looking for sense, will be looking for a way to work together more. What I hear you say also is that the American model is one that promotes innovation in itself, in its creativity, in the way, in its optimism, and that if combined with a more European Indian sense of culture, it could be the ideal civilization, and it could actually be a more sustainable civilization than the one we've got today. Am I summarizing what you're saying?
That's exactly right. I think, in other words, we shouldn't throw the baby with the bathwater, so to speak, right? And I think that's why when I go to bookstores in America, I'm a bit worried, because I see all these titles like, you know, The Decline of America, and, you know, America is, you know basically like going to disappear, whatever. And I don't think so. I mean, actually, America is able to reinvent itself all the time. And you're right. I think COVID is bringing a new ingredient to the mix, which is this emphasis on community. And so this is where I think we shouldn't forget that everything we just talked about is connected to politics too, and what we call democracy, right? So that means that what Americans don't like is to be told what to do, in a way, right? That's also why I'm sorry, but that's what I also don't like to be told what. That's why I've been like a self-employed, right, for 25 years, because I like to be my own boss. That's who I am. I'm an entrepreneur. So the question then is, yes, we are going to have a communal approach, but it should be built on voluntary participation, right? So we cannot force people to say, hey, you know, Tai shall collaborate, right? Tai shall, you know. So the question then is like, you know, how do you do that? My take on that is we need to have more podcasts like yours, more positive media news that actually showcase this new America, which is emerging, right? Where essentially we value as much individual expression as social integration. And why I say this is because one of the things I see happening in France when I compare with America is that there is more and more, you know, so governance innovation in politics, and some of the ideas we talked about today are happening not in Paris, in the capital, but in the regions, right? So the same way what I see happening in America is that you will see a lot of amazing innovation happening in political governance, in social models, economic models, but they may be happening in a decentralized
grassroots level,
right? In different states, grassroots level. And America has always been about grassroots innovation and grassroots, you know, transformation. And that's why I'm very interested to see is, yes, we have a new administration, which is fantastic. They're going to support this transformation, but they can create at best a framework. That's it. But then the actual implementation of the changes have to be done at local level. Right. And so the ownership of driving this transformation has to be completely.
And when you think of the audio clip we just heard by John Michael, what are the strengths of the key values of these countries that we could exploit to make this change happen?
That one value that I really appreciate in this country is meritocracy. This idea that, you know, where you come from doesn't matter. What matters is where we are going together collectively. And that's why I say these days that America for me is not a place or even a noun. It's actually a verb, right? It's a dynamic. And you make America what you want. And so we talk about the freedom. And there is one important freedom is the freedom to be. And it took me 20 years to grasp it. Right. And I realized only today that, you know, as 50 after 20 years in this country, that, my God, that's an incredible freedom. The problem is we don't know what to do with that freedom. So I think Eric Fromm, who was a famous sociologist and psychoanalyst, wrote a book called Escape from Freedom, because too much freedom is also, you know, constraining, paradoxically. Right. We have too many choices. So I would say that, you know, the values in this country is about freedom. But I would say in a cynical way that up to now, the freedom to consume. I think now we should shift into higher gear and think about using this freedom to reinvent our communities, do good in the planet, in the world. So I think this is how we should basically, you know, cherish, celebrate, value this freedom, but apply it wisely.
Yeah, I'm still dubious to see how. I mean, look at what happened on the Capitol. Look at 4 years of Trump. Look at the mass thing recently in this country. Look at worldwide. Look at what's happening in Hong Kong. The rise of populism. Democracy is suffering. Women's rights. I mean, if you want to be pessimistic, there are so many things to look at just to start to cry, right? And yet you are here telling me that you believe that humanity has a way out of all that doom, and that you see example of people coming together to create a more sustainable way. So what do you make of all the bad stuff that you see around you? How do you explain that?
Well, I would explain a simple way, right? It may sound very, you know, hoo-hoo or very esoteric, but or spiritual, actually, is when you see a lot of darkness, for me, that's evidence that there is also growing light. It's called the law of correspondence, right? In hermeneutics, actually, John Greer can explain better than me. So essentially, opposites coexist. So that means that if you see more and more anti-democratic movement, that means that there's a counterweight, right? There's actually also more commitment to democracy happening, right? So if we see more people actually saying like climate deniers, we are going to see the opposite force as well. For every action, there's a reaction, as in physics. So I actually welcome the fact that, you know, there is so much resistance to change, because that means that there is a counter movement also that I belong to, which is going to double up and triple up our commitment and efforts to change. I think that's really what's happening. Before, right, it was nice to just tweet, you know, Black Lives Matter, I'm sorry to say that, right, or women's right, but now it's going to be about, you know, roll up your sleeves, right, and get to work, right? Can you give your life to defend those values? So that we talk about values, right? Values not just like a poster, right, that you put on your house windows, which I saw everywhere in New York, right, Black Lives Matter. The question is actually like, you know, how many Black people you have in your senior leadership team in a company, right? I won't embarrass Trade Organization America, which is a very prestigious, you know, apex body in America. I saw on the website, on the landing page, Black Lives Matter. So being cynical, I went to, you know, the members of the advisory board and the senior leadership team. I couldn't find one Black person. So this is what's going to happen, right? So it's no longer enough to say, well, you know, we need to fight, you know, we need to fight racism and bigotry and sexism. No, now it's about being congruent between what you say and what you do. And again, coming back to the reason I'm optimistic is that the young people as consumers, employees, and citizens are going to vote with their wallet, with their degrees, and with the vote for those people who actually are congruent between what they say and what they do, whether they are CEOs or politicians or brands.
We are getting at the end of this interview, and as you know, I have always two questions. You started to answer on the first one, which is what is America to you? And the second one will also be if you have books or movie to recommend. What is America to you?
For me, as I said, America is a verb, right? It's what you make out of it, right? So I think, you know, if I were to repeat or paraphrase Kennedy, I would say like, you know, it's not about what America can do for you, right? It's what can you do for America, right? So I actually believe America being a country that I can help evolve, And that's what makes me optimistic, because it's a country where they don't care where I come from. And it's fact. It's a fact. In 20 years, I've been in this country. You know, I never say it publicly, but I'm telling you today, since you're also French. In 20 years, I've been in this country. I never heard when a conversation starts, someone asks me where you're from. They may ask me where you live now, but not where you are from, right? But in France, during the 7 years I spent studying in Paris, the first question would always be like, you know, oh, where are you from? You speak French, what's your story? Right? So people asking me a lot about background, and I hated that. I'm sorry to say that, right? So I like the fact in America, people don't care where I come from. They care about where we collectively can go and what role I can play to, you know, reinvent the American dream, to make it more inclusive and more ecologically sound. So that's what America is for me.
Interesting. I'm really sorry about the comments in France, but it's not surprising.
It's better now. It's better now. I must say that.
It's better. Any books? Any movies?
The movie I recommend is because it's called Losers. It's on Netflix. It's a documentary. And it really goes against this notion that, you know, America is all about success stories. You know, we highly value the heroes, you know, the people who made it, who are very successful. And as the title says, right, Losers is actually a documentary about people who are athletes. And all these people essentially reached the almost top, either they reached the top, then fell, or failed just before reaching the top. But actually, the film actually shows how failure is the best teacher you can have. And I think it's important for America to listen to that, because I think I believe that since 9/11 happened, America has trouble, you know, accepting that, you know, things can go wrong, right? And be humble enough to learn lessons, right, from failures that are, you know, self-induced, or in the case of terrorist attack, something happens, right? So because we always value things that work, success stories, right, and the heroes, etc. So I think Losers is a documentary that shows that vulnerability, you know, is more important than feeling invincible, right? So that's an interesting documentary. And then in terms of books, I would say that, the book The Evolving Self by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi is a very, very good book. And being a spiritual person, my hometown is the birthplace of a very famous Indian philosopher named Sri Aurobindo. And he has written several books. One of them is called Life Divine. And his writings have inspired a very well-known American philosopher named Ken Wilber. So I would recommend you to look at the writings of Sri Aurobindo, who is the father of what is known as integral yoga.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Before I let you go, if our listener wants concrete proof of something going in the right direction in the US, where would you send them to? You know, who would be an example? Who would embody this positive change today?
I may be naive, but I think I would look at the White House. because that's the best place, right? After 4 years of what we saw, look at the speed at which we are reversing all the bad things that happened the last 4 years, right? So I'm saying look at the White House, not only for the occupants of the White House, because yes, I think Joe Biden and also Kamala Harris, right, electing a woman, South Asian and descent and black woman as a vice president, right? So that shows the meritocracy, as I say, right? That's one of the value of America. So I say, look at White House not only because to see how we are able to bring change into political governance, but also to see how fast, right, America can change. I mean, you have no idea, Stan. I'm amazed. For example, right, so I would say two places to look at. White House is one area, and then remember that when at the beginning I said, you know, we need to go beyond sustainability, right, to this notion of regeneration. Well, guess which country is embracing wholeheartedly this idea? It's America. And there is a famous organization called Sustainable Brands. This is a company that educates American companies how to adopt sustainability practices. And this year, they are massively helping the members to transition to this notion of regeneration. So you can see the speed at which this shift is happening from the horror we saw in the last 4 years to, you know, taking this country in the right direction. I'm, you know, quite impressed. So I would say look at the White House and then check out this organization called Sustainable Brands.
Thank you, Navy. Thank you, and goodbye, everyone. Bye-bye for now.